From the Masters in golf to the master of the boxing ring, our special guest today has covered it all in award-winning fashion, and what stories he will share with you shortly. Kelly Elbin here, welcoming you to another episode of Musings on Golf. Jenna Self, our executive producer, is the wizard behind the scenes, getting our podcast to sound good and flow beautifully. And that's my segue into Dave Kindred, one of the great sports writers of all time. You talk about words flowing off the typewriter and keyboards and all the other mechanisms that for years he used to tell some of the great stories in sports. We're going to talk a lot with Dave about golf, but to just talk golf with Dave Kindred is to cheat you, the listener. You're going to hear about his time with Muhammad Ali. You're going to hear about when he retired and going back to Illinois, where he grew up, and covering a girls' high school basketball team and writing a book about it. It's a really, really special interview. And a special story that Matt Fitzpatrick wrote in winning the Valspar Championship on Sunday. Good for him. Matt Fitzpatrick, I was so impressed with him in coming up short, and as he really identifies it, not necessarily losing the Players' Championship, but Cameron Young just got it done. He made a great shot at 17 on the Island Green, made birdie, and then had great drive at 18 and beat Fitzpatrick. And I know that hurt him, but as Fitzpatrick said, he kind of got back on the horse this past week. This time he found the winner's circle. This time he's the one who made birdie on 18 to capture the Valspar Championship. I want to talk a little bit about playing golf with David Young,
Cameron's dad.
Let's hear how much it meant to Matt Fitzpatrick to come back a week after he came up so short in tough fashion.
Obviously, there's more frustration when you don't feel like you've done a lot wrong, and you don't feel like you've lost it. You know, you feel like obviously someone's come and taken it away from you. So there was definitely more frustration on that part. Yeah, and turning up this week was something that, you know, I felt like I was playing well. So I think in previous times when I've had good finishes, particularly in Europe, it's almost been easy for me to not switch off. Switch off isn't the right word, but it's like, right, I've had a good finish. I can kind of coast a little bit this week. And I made sure that this week I wasn't going to do that. You know, I knew that I was playing well, and it was like, let's just keep pushing and give ourselves the best chance we can.
Quite frankly, like a lot of the European golfers in this person's opinion, it's hard to root against Matt Fitzpatrick. And when it comes to the Ryder Cup or what have you, he's just a good guy. And I was very happy for him. And as you said, he got back on that horse and got to that winner's circle. And again, as we get closer and closer to the Masters, winning events and not coming up short can mean so much to him. And I was so, so darn impressed with him and the way he treated Cameron Young's parents the week before, giving them a hug. Had a chance to play golf this past week with David Young, Cameron's dad, and his longtime instructor. David was the head professional for more than 20 years at Sleepy Hollow Country Club in New York, and a good man, quiet guy, terrific PGA professional, cares deeply about the game, and he and his wife, Barbara, who has caddied for Cameron at many events, and by the way, would love to caddy for Cameron in the par 3 tournament at the Masters, but unfortunately Cameron's wife Kelsey gets the nod, as she should, on the bag for the par 3 coming up on Wednesday at the Masters. But David, as I mentioned, good man, went to Virginia Tech, wasn't necessarily looking to have a career in golf, but was a solid player, wasn't on scholarship there, actually ended up playing as a non-scholarship golfer in his senior year, then became, as I mentioned, head professional at Sleepy Hollow, where Cameron grew up. Tell you what, for a guy who hadn't really played much golf at East Point Country Club here, with Derek Nyzak, our head professional, and Jimmy Rattigan, our reigning club champion, David played pretty well. He had made 14 pars, I don't know, shot 76, somewhere in that range. Really enjoyed the time. Well, and David and his wife, Barbara, are back out with Cameron this week at the Texas Children's Houston Open, traveling with Cameron, as they do for every tour event, with him every step of the way, whether it's on the range, walking along the ropes, inside the ropes, except for the Masters, which he told me, I hadn't been aware of this, the teachers, instructors, even during practice rounds at the Masters, are not allowed to follow their players inside the ropes. He also told me something I thought was really interesting. He was talking about certain shots that Cameron likes to hit or pair for at the Masters. He says he's carried and used a four hybrid for only one shot at Augusta National. And it's on the on number 10, the dogleg left downhill, where he likes that four hybrid off the tee. He's not sure if he's going to use it in a couple of weeks, but he, you know, he catches that right part of the that correct part of the fairway, and the ball, you know, ricochets down, and at least gives him a relatively reasonable second shot into that great par four. Speaking of great, again, Dave Kindred, I was so pleased that we were able to get Dave on the show. I grew up in the D.C. area, as I'll mention in the interview, and Dave was one of the great writers for the Washington Post sports section, which incredibly no longer exists. I have my own feelings about that, and Dave certainly shares those. You'll hear all that from Dave Kindred right after this from our great corporate partners at William & Harry and the Friars Golf Club. When golfer and entrepreneur Rhett Butler founded William & Harry Golf, he brought luxury, individuality, and performance to the game while giving back through support of veterans organizations and suicide prevention initiatives. This spring, William & Harry Golf unveils its 2026 collection, perhaps the most innovative, most comfortable, and most distinctive lineup of handcrafted golf shoes. They feature vibrant colors in both exotic python and ostrich, and classic golf colors for our Calfskins line of shoes, which have already been recognized by Golf Digest, comfort and quality. William & Harry is the luxury golf brand with a conscience, built on trust in our craftsmanship, our values, and our promise to reinvest in the communities we serve. When you choose William & Harry, you choose a brand that stands behind every product, every cause, and the causes it supports. Visit williamandharry.com, the luxury golf brand with a conscience. Is your golf life stuck in a bunker of country club hassles? Tired of the wait lists and the six-figure initiation fees? Well, at the Friars Golf Club, we take care of all of the hard work, planning exclusive trips and unforgettable rounds on top-rated courses, so all you have to do is show up, have fun, and make lifelong friendships on the first tee, the 19th hole, and far beyond. Our terrific 2026 lineup includes international destinations like Dubai and Scandinavia, plus top domestic resorts such as Sand Valley and Black Desert, and access to some great private clubs. Join the Friars Golf Club today. Email us at info@thefriars.com, the word musings in the subject line, to receive a $500 trip credit. When you join, we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience with the Friars Golf Club. Our special guest today is one of America's greatest sports writers. He is the recipient of the 2010 PGA Lifetime Achievement Award in journalism and is a member of both the U.S. Basketball Writers Hall of Fame and the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association Hall of Fame. In 1991, he was the recipient of the prize that he says he holds dearest, and that being the Red Smith Award, given by the Associated Press Sports Editors Organization for outstanding contributions to sports journalism. As golf is concerned, he covered 51 Masters, more than 100 major golf championships, and are we ever going to cover a whole lot of ground with him today? He's the pride of Atlanta, Illinois. Dave Kindred, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to Musings on Golf. How are you, Dave?
I'm very good, Kelly. Thank you very much.
Hey, Dave, your life as a sports writer has been phenomenal in so many ways. And we're going to talk a lot of golf, obviously, because this is a golf podcast. But I would be very remiss if we didn't maybe put some context into your career. Early on, you were told by an editor, the paper you were working in Louisville, that fellow by the name of Cassius Clay was in town. And Dave, that began a rather remarkable career of covering the gentleman who went on to become a Muhammad Ali. You interviewed him more than 300 times, wrote a book about Ali and Howard Cosell. How did that process begin as far as that, maybe that first interview, And it 300 times interviewing anybody is a lot of interviews.
Well, it's almost not fair to say you interviewed Ali 300 times. Basically, you listened to Ali 300 times. I was 24 years old when I got the job in Louisville, Kentucky at the Courier-Journal. They had no writing job, so I was a copy desk editor. And one day, the boss came in and said, "Clay's in town. Go find him." Well, you know, I had never been able to find my way around Louisville, let alone find the most famous man in the world. So I just went out. His father had an art shop. I went to the father, Cassius Clay Sr. He said, "He's over there." And he just pointed to the west end of Louisville. I drove around. I had my son with me that day, 3 years old, Jeff. We drove around. I stopped and asked somebody, "Have you seen Cassius today?" Everybody had seen Cassius that day. So I found him. He rode around in my car with me for the day. I wrote about it. It was the first time I wrote about Ali. It was 1966. I wrote about him for the next 50 years. I've written more words about him than any subject in my life, except perhaps, and maybe we'll get to it, the Morton Lady Potters basketball team.
Oh, we're going to get to that a little later on in this interview, Dave. What were your very first impressions of Clay with him sitting in the car with you and your son?
Well, first of all, he appreciated the fact that I called him Muhammad, because the newspaper at that time referred to him all the time as Cassius Clay, comma, a.k.a. Muhammad Ali. I always wrote about him as Muhammad Ali. He was charming. He was a sweetheart. The Ali that I met when he was 24, I was 22. He was the sweetheart forever. The whole Ali, the kind of dark side of Ali, I never saw. I saw it on film. I've read about it. But when I was with him, when I was around him, he was always a sweetheart. He was funny, of course. He was a showman. He was just a beautiful person to begin with. Beautiful, athletic person. He was 6'3", 200. He could do anything. I saw him at Madison Square Garden once. He picked up a basketball and made a shot from midcourt. He never played basketball. He was just a great natural athlete, a great natural performer. You know, the greatest athlete I ever saw.
And you made an interesting point there when we think in golf circles about Tiger Woods in his heyday being maybe the most recognizable person in the world, or Ali or Lionel Messi, that type of person. But to your point, Ali clearly was the most recognizable person in the world for an extended period of time, Dave.
I think Time magazine one time did a list like that. Number one in the world was the Pope. Number two was Muhammad Ali. And his fame extended, you know, around, literally around the world. He was better known perhaps in Africa than he was in the United States even. You know, he was a phenomenon of the time. He embodied all the greatness of the time and all kind of the darkness of the time. And you could write 12 books about Ali and never begin to understand him, never begin to explain him.
Remember, there was a PGA championship that was played at Valhalla Golf Club in his hometown of Louisville. And he was there one time. I can't remember which one it was, but I was amazed just how many golfers looked up to him. And it was a big, big deal that Muhammad Ali was on the golf course.
There were so many reasons to admire him. So many reasons. First of all, I mean, he was just, as I said, he was a beautiful person, not a beautiful physical specimen. You could not take your eyes off him when you saw him. Plus, he loved people. He wanted people around him. Celebrities today hire bodyguards to keep people away. Ali wanted people around him. There were times when it would just be me and him, like in a hotel room. He would want to go out on the street just to see people. And he'd be standing on a corner and, you know, 10 minutes, there'd be 1,000 people there. He loved that. So he was a phenomenon in so many different ways as an athlete. He was, I've always said, I don't care what you're talking about, football, basketball, baseball, any of it. Ali was the greatest athlete I ever saw. I mean, he could do things that you can't imagine doing. And as, even as a fighter, he was a different personality every fight. And when I say personality, I mean just different tactics and strategy. He could do anything.
Well, and then you wrote a terrific book in 2006 entitled Sound and Fury, Two Powerful Lives, One Fateful Friendship. Really went very deep, Dave Kindred, in exploring that relationship between Ali and the legendary sportscaster Howard Cosell. You know, we saw Cosell on ABC all those years covering the bouts and being there with Ali. But it was really a rather remarkable relationship between two guys from extremely different backgrounds, right?
Well, that's why I wrote that book, Kelly. You know, I wanted to write a book. You know, anybody who was around Ali, if you were a writer, you wanted to write it because it was such a great story all the time. So many different elements made him a great story. So I wanted to write a biography of Ali. But Ali at that time, and I'm talking now about the late 70s, still people saw him as, they weren't sure of him. They weren't sure if they liked him, hated him, or what. They just knew he was there as a celebrity. I couldn't get a publisher interested in a book about Ali. Nobody wanted to touch that. But I had also developed a relationship with Cosell, because Cosell was as big in television as Ali was big in everything. And I proposed to a publisher, how about a biography of Ali and Cosell? Because Cosell attached himself to Ali early on. He recognized what we're talking about, that Ali was, and I've said this many times, Cosell was always the star of every room he was ever in, except with Ali. He catered to Ali. He bowed to Ali. He understood who the real star was. He made jokes about it. But Ali was always the star. Cosell was there he was there just as a secondary character in the play. And they had a relationship that was, both of them had been despised. Both of them came to be admired. Ali more than Cosell, for that matter. But it was a dynamic relationship that enhanced Ali's performance, enhanced Ali's character, and certainly made Cosell's character.
Dave, did the two of them genuinely like/love one another, or was it just for the show?
They understood the relationship. They understood that they were good for each other. You know, Ali played with Cosell, made jokes about Cosell. Cosell would not have abided that from anyone else. But he understood who was the top banana in that act. I don't think they ever loved each other. They certainly respected each other and were on call. If Ali needed Cosell, Cosell was there. Cosell in the same way. I think they were partners. In the book, I go through a list of, you know, entertainment partnerships, Martin and Lewis, Abbott and Costello, Ali and Cosell.
They were certainly at that level for, I mean, a very long time. Dave Kindred, the great sports writer, joining us here on Musings on Golf. Dave, let's segue and talk about another legend as we conduct this interview on March 23rd. It's a Monday. We are exactly 2 weeks away from the start of Masters Week 2026. I mentioned in the introduction that you covered 51 Masters for a variety of publications. What do you remember about seeing Augusta National Golf Club for the first time and covering your very first Masters?
Well, it's a memory that's vivid even today, this long. I had played golf. I was a caddy when I was 12 years old. I had played golf. One of my first jobs at a real newspaper was covering golf. At the Bloomington, Illinois Daily Pantograph. I was their golf writer. I went to Louisville in 1966. You know, I knew nothing really, but I knew it. They hired me as a golf writer. And in March, I guess, of 67, sports editor said, "How would you like to go to Augusta? How would you like to go to a heaven?" You know, okay, yeah. I'll go. You know, so I go to Augusta. It was in 1967. Went to the Quonset hut where we handed out the credentials. I asked the lady in charge, because I had two goals when I went to Augusta that year. I was 25 years old. I asked the woman, which in the press tent? I said, where does Red Smith sit? She pointed out Red Smith, who I thought was the greatest sports writer. I still think is the greatest sports writer ever. I stood behind, stood maybe 10, 15 feet behind Red Smith and just watched him type for maybe 10, 15 minutes. And then I went to the practice range and watched Ben Hogan hit balls. I had two purposes at Augusta. I wanted to see Red Smith. I wanted to see Ben Hogan. And that year, 67, happened to be the last time that Hogan was a factor at Augusta. And I still remember the Saturday. Hogan shoots 36 on the front. He birdies, I think, 10, 11, and 13, something. Now he's like three under, and people in the press tent are saying, Hogan's making birdies. Let's go see. So at that time, from the press room, there was a bleachers grandstand where a press stand alongside the 18th green. You climb up on the press stand. You can see people coming up the fairway. You can see them on the green. So now we see Hogan, who is now, let's see, he's five under. He's five under on the back. He's like two shots out of the lead. He's 51 years old. He's limping because even then he still is feeling the injuries and the aches and pains, both of old age and of the car accident that almost killed him. He's climbing up that hill to the 18th green. He's limping. And huge crowd for that time. Now it's a be a nothing crowd. But there were people there. They understood what was happening. There was applause as he was trudging up the hill. He's on the green now. He's got a birdie putt, maybe 20 feet above the hole, and he can't draw the putter back. And it seems forever. Even now, it seems forever. Even now, I'm watching, wow. And he's this little old guy, and he can't get the putter back. Finally, he does. The ball is rolling slowly. You know, Kelly, what that green is. You know, and it falls in. It's 30 on the back. 36, 30, 66. He's now two shots out of the lead going into Sunday. You know, that's my first Masters. It's still my best Masters.
So Dave, I wonder if you could also, in addition to the lovely story that you told about Mr. Hogan, can you elaborate, please, on Red Smith? I mentioned at the outset that when you won that award from the AP that And I later read that was you said that was the highlight of your career. For those who never read a word that Red Smith wrote and only sort of heard about him, what was it about Red Smith that impacted so many writers through the years?
Red Smith was my hero long before I ever saw Red Smith, long before I ever met him. I read him because his language was so soft. There was music to his words. You read it, and it's almost as if you're reading poetry. I'd read a lot of sports writers. I had all the books, Fireside Book of Baseball, Fireside Book of Boxing. I wanted to be a sports writer. I wanted to be in that world. And Red Smith was in that world, and his voice was different from everyone else's. His voice was, as I said, his voice to me sounded like music. You know, if you're interested at all in great writing, let alone great sports writing, you read Red Smith. Red Smith was not that he held himself above sports writing. He thought sports writing was an honorable profession, you know, as important as anything else in the newspaper, maybe more important. Certainly it was. He made it real life. You know, you could see that, you could feel the drama in his voice. And so that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be able to write something that was even a pale facsimile of what Red Smith did for 50 years.
If to your point about Mr. Smith and his feeling about sports, it was hardly all that he wrote about. In fact, he won the 1976 Pulitzer Prize commentary So his interests and his writing went well beyond the playing fields and courts and of sports.
Well, he was able to connect sports to that real world. That was the thing that I enjoyed most about it. It was no longer just figures, statistics, and numbers. You know, he knew people. He could bring a person alive on the page. You could hear the other person's laughter. You could hear the other person's anger. You know, he was a great observer of the human condition, is what he was. And you didn't find many of those in sports writing. You know, most sports is like who won. Red cared about a whole lot of things beyond who won.
It's a personal thrill for me to be joined by one of the great sports writers of all time, Dave Kindred, here on Musings on Golf. And Dave, I use the word great because it's appropriate and true for you. And I also use the word personal, you know, in large part because I grew up in the D.C. area, and the Washington Post sports section for me and millions of others in the D.C. area, it was our daily Bible of sorts. Great writers like yourself, columnist Shirley Povich and Tom Boswell on the baseball side, Tony Kornheiser and Michael Wilbon, who people know maybe a little bit better today. And now Dave Kindred, almost incredible to believe, there is no more sports section in the Washington Post. For me, kind of like a death in the family, and I'm not exaggerating. Wondering how you felt when you first learned that the sports section of the Washington Post was no more.
You've used the exact right phrasing there, Kelly, death in the family. I mean, I worked there for about 10 years. I left there for a variety of reasons, but I never really left the Washington Post psychically. It was the greatest thing in my journalism career was being hired there by George Solomon, then the sports editor, at a newspaper that then was the most famous newspaper in the world, perhaps. It was shortly after Watergate. I was there when the Redskins won a Super Bowl for the first time. To me, first of all, Kelly, and I hate to say this, but it's true. I mean, it feels like a part of my life has ended. Not so much with the Washington Post, but with journalism and newspaper journalism in its entirety. You know, it's nothing. In my period of time, I was so lucky to be in newspaper journalism when newspaper journalism mattered. Now it doesn't matter much because newspapers have basically died. You know, I was in fact writing a biography, basically a history of the Washington Post when the newspaper business collapsed. I began that book, Morning Miracle. Mm-hmm. Morning Miracle is what newspapers were. Before I got halfway through that book, the business fell apart. This classified ads disappeared from newspapers. Newspapers lost their major way of making money. Newspapers began to die. I didn't recognize it. But the book began as a tribute to newspapers, and it ended as an epitaph for newspapers. And that epitaph for newspapers, now I'm talking about 2009, has done nothing but become bleaker and darker over the years. And now, for the first time in my life, I'm 84 years old, Kelly. I'm 84 years old. I've had a newspaper in my hands every day from maybe the time I was 8 or 9 years old until maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I don't have a newspaper anymore. I read newspapers, newspapers online, but it's not the same thing as holding the newspaper in your hand and feeling the newspaper. And that's what Red Smith did for me. It's what newspapers did for me forever. And to me, it's a great loss in our society.
Couldn't agree with you anymore, particularly that last remark. And Dave, the landscape for the modern day sports writer, it's certainly demanding. It is hardly just cover a game, write the game story, or write a column and go home. You've got blogs and you know, you've got to keep pace with everything that's going on in the sports world. And that's the world we live in. But I found in doing some research, you had some similar demands when you played baseball at Illinois Wesleyan, your alma mater, and you covered basketball games. Obviously, the two seasons were not necessarily concurrent. But, Dave, you had a lot on your plate as a college student.
As I said, Kelly, I'm 84 years old, and I look back at that period of time you're talking about. Let's say I'm 21 years old when I'm a senior at Illinois right. Wesleyan. Not only am I a senior at Illinois Wesleyan, I'm working full-time at the Daily Pantograph in Bloomington. I'm allegedly a student preparing for tests and such. Not only that, I'm married, and my wife is in nursing school in Springfield, Illinois, which is 60 miles south of Bloomington. And I'm now at 84 wondering, how did I do that? How did I do that? Right. I have no idea how I did that, you know, but I knew that I loved it all. I wanted it all. And something had to be slighted, and it was my time at Illinois Wesleyan as a student. I was still a baseball player. I was playing second base. Shortstop was a great shortstop. And Doug Rader played 15 years in the big leagues. That's when I realized that I better become a sports writer, you know, because this kid can play and I can't. You know, so it was a great time in my life that it made my life. It is my life.
What'd you cover? Did you cover like local high school games for the paper that time?
I was doing it. My time at the Daily Pantograph, there were three people in the sports department. There was the sports editor, Jim Barnhart, his assistant, Roger Cushman, and me. I was a copy desk guy. I put the paper out every night. Tuesdays and Fridays were basketball nights. You know, I took scores on the phone. I oversaw a staff of like 20 part-timers who would come in and take phone calls on basketball games, because the Pantograph at that time covered a circulation area that was maybe 70 high schools. So there'd be basketball games every Tuesday and Friday.
I'd have a lot of agate being called in, right?
And I had to add it all up. It was the greatest training anybody could possibly have. I did everything. There was nothing I ever did in sports journalism after that that was more difficult than what I did on Tuesday and Friday nights at the Daily Pantograph, where all I did then was I'd have a speed graphic camera. I'd go out to a local basketball game, shoot some pictures, come in, develop the pictures. My wife always wondered why I had all these white spots on my shirts. Those were the chemicals that are necessary to produce pictures were splattering onto my shirt. You know, so I did everything. It was the most fun that I ever had as a sports writer.
Our friends at William and Harry are always looking for ways to stand out in the crowd. So for anyone who belongs to a country club, William and Harry can have your shoes private labeled to fit your specific needs. The same applies to your company or any organization you might be affiliated with. This makes you a clear winner. Why? Well, you have a better quality shoe that feels great, and you have the logo of your club, company, or organization on your shoes that really makes you stand out on the golf course. To learn more, visit williamandharry.com today and be sure to input our promotional code 15OFF, M-O-G, for a 15% discount at williamandharry.com. Golf is more than your scorecard, the brand of clubs you play, or the clothes you wear. Golf is a journey where every round is a memory, filled with friends old and new. The Friars Golf Club is where those lifelong friendships are made, on the first tee, in the 19th hole, and far beyond. Exclusive trips, unforgettable rounds, and the very best people. Indeed, great courses are simply better with great company. So join the Friars today. To learn more, email us at info@thefriars.com and put the word musings in the subject line to receive a $500 trip credit when you join. So we invite you to stop dreaming and start living the ultimate golf experience at the Friars Golf Club. Sounds like you had a great mom. It was your mom at what, you were 15 when your mom gave you a typewriter as a birthday gift. And tell our listeners, please, the first three words or the full name that that you typed out and why?
I still have that typewriter, by the way, Kelly. You know, it's and it still works. It keeps oiled. I sat at our kitchen table. My 15th birthday, she bought it for $5 at a neighborhood auction, brought it home. She knew that I wanted to be a writer. You know, I had to listen to basketball games on the radio and then written little stories on paper. She brought home the typewriter. I put in a piece of paper, sat there for maybe 10 minutes, say, long time, thinking, I want to remember forever the first words I ever typed. Now that, I think, shows that I had decided that's what I wanted to do for a living. I wanted to be a sports writer. So I'm sitting there. 15 minutes later, I type Stanley Frank Musial. Stan Musial. Stan the man. I listened to Harry Carey on the radio every night from the time I was 10 until I left home and went to college, 18. You know, that's when Harry Carey was a real professional sports broadcaster. No one, he was years away from being the character, the cartoon that he became. He was a serious baseball guy. He understood baseball. He knew how to play. He knew the intricacies of the game. And whatever I knew about baseball at that time, I learned from listening to Harry Carey. So Stanley Frank Musial, I think he's underappreciated even today. You know, one of the five or six great baseball players of all time, great baseball hitters, at least, of all time.
And baseball at that time was also, as you said, with Harry Carey, it was a relatively regional game, and that's who you heard, and that was your team that you heard from April through September.
Oh, the Cardinals were, I learned this much later. I listened to the Cardinals on KMOX. I could get that signal in central Illinois. At that time, I'd go to bed every night listening to Harry Carey. Sometimes I would hear Harry say, well, it's the 15th inning, and if you've had a Budweiser, every time I've told you to have a Budweiser, you're feeling good. Well, he was probably feeling good himself. So I listened then, and I learned later that the KMOX had a 50,000-watt clear channel signal. So Cardinal Nation was basically everything east of the Mississippi and south of the Mason-Dixon line. The first time that I really learned that was when I went to Daytona 500. I'm talking to Richard Petty, one of the great races, run the great race car drivers of all time from Randleman, North Carolina. And the thing we had in common was that I discovered that everybody in that part of the country were Cardinal fans. So every time I saw Richard Petty, we would just talk about baseball, talk about the Cardinals.
Wondering, with all of the sports that you covered, you mentioned in that case NASCAR, boxing, basketball, baseball, so forth. Wondering, how did covering the sport of golf and its competitors, how did that compare to the other sports that you covered? Did you enjoy it as much as covering Ali, as much as covering a great basketball game?
Well, one of the things I liked about golf originally was that because I worked in Kentucky, I worked in Illinois and Kentucky before those were my early jobs. It was always basketball all winter. So I was indoors at basketball games all winter. I'd probably see 100 basketball games. Augusta comes, the sun is shining. You go to Georgia, it's warm. The azaleas are blooming. It's a beautiful scene and it's quiet. You know, it's relatively quiet. You're not confined in a basketball hall anymore, being pummeled by noise. You can hear the birds singing. I love just the feel of Augusta, and it's a beautiful layout anyway. And then the golf became, I understood golf a little bit at the time. I came to understand it as well as a newspaper man can ever understand it. Later, it was almost like going to college to learn about golf, because you'd hear Hogan talk, you'd hear Snead talk, you'd hear young Jack Nicklaus talk. You know, you'd understand what the competitive nature of these guys. You know, yeah, they're not knocking each other down, they're not trying to beat up anybody, but it's just as competitive, just as insightful, just as demanding of their body. I used to think it was, you know, what's the big deal about walking? until I got to be some age on me. Then I understood that those hills at Augusta National are not small hills. You have to be in pretty good physical condition to walk that course. And now we're not talking about walking as a spectator. You're talking about walking as a competitor. You're walking down the center of every fairway. You're walking it maybe 6 times, 8 times that week, depending on how much you want to practice, you know, and you're racking up miles. You know, I came to admire the tenacity, the even the tensile strength that was necessary to play golf. You know, if your one hand is hurting, you know, that's like your leg is hurting if you're a football player. You know, so I came to admire them as athletes, you know, in a game that a lot of people think is because most of us, even most of us, what, 90% of people who play golf, 98% of people who play golf just sit in a car and ride around. These guys are walking not only for the four rounds of a tournament 20 times a year, they're walking that course every day of the year.
So, Dave Kindred, I'm wondering, through all of the years and tournaments that you covered, were there any golfers among the elite level who you were particularly who were favorites of yours? You enjoyed interviewing. You learned from them.
Jack Nicklaus. You got to begin with Nicklaus all the time. He was the master of the post-round interview. I loved Arnold Palmer. Palmer was, you know, if anything, he was as close to a common guy as you could get. But they enjoyed the camaraderie. They enjoyed the talking to the press. I always look for the eccentric guys. I like them. Mac O'Grady. I don't know if anybody remembers Mac O'Grady, but he was a good player for a while. I loved Gary McCord. I've quoted McCord 100 times. McCord, of course, became more famous as an announcer, but I still remember his description of golf, G-O-L-F, the genetic overflow of living fluids. That was his idea of how hard it was to be a golfer at the top level. Bert Yancey was a great story. Bert Yancey could have been one of the great players of all time, had a mental illness. I wrote a long piece for Golf Digest on him. And of course, I was there for the whole Tiger Woods era, from the time his first round my last round. My first Masters was Ben Hogan. My last Masters was Tiger Woods in 2019. 2019, Tiger won for the fifth time, his last time. And I figured that was okay. I'm done with the Masters. You know, I can't do better than that. But Tiger was a great character that I never really appreciated, never really understood. Tiger from the beginning, like Arnold Palmer was the most generous of superstars you've ever seen in golf. Tiger was the least, Tiger was the stingiest. Arnold would share everything with you. Tiger shared nothing with you. Tiger gave you the clinical, he'd appear post round. He'd talk clinically about golf, but you never got a feeling for the person. That came later. 2019, he was more of a person then than ever. Yes. And that's why I like that Tiger. Didn't like the earlier Tigers.
You know, I had the good fortune of sitting next to all those top players during and moderating press conferences during the PGA Championship for a number of years in the Ryder Cup when it was played in the U.S. And I agree with that. I think that Tiger was incredibly good at a 30-minute stretch of answering one question after another without really saying a whole lot or ever letting you get into any part of his life. And he maintained that, to your point, for quite some time. And I suppose with age, things change in so many ways. And he is a very different individual now, very different than he was at the height of his powers.
Well, I forget, Kelly, who it was said of, but it's a famous quote. He learned to say, hello when it was time to say goodbye.
Yeah.
I think that was said of a New York Yankees shortstop named Mark Koenig once upon a time. But Tiger is a phenomenon unto himself. He was the one and the only of those guys. And for a dozen reasons, 100 reasons that we know nothing about, he hid himself from us. So it was very hard to root for Tiger. It was like rooting for General Motors, to make more cars. Whereas Palmer, and it's unfair to compare anybody to Arnold Palmer, because Palmer was just an open face to the world. He invited the world in. Tiger closed the world out.
Our mutual friend, Frank Herzog, longtime voice of the Redskins on the radio with Sam Huff and Sonny Jurgensen. And you're the first person you mentioned when I asked you the question was Jack and how good he was with the media. And Frank told me the story once. I think it was the first. Oh, Kemper Open, I think it was. It was played at Congressional, 1980. And after one of the rounds, Frank went up to Jack and asked him, a couple of questions. He said Jack was very gracious with his time, and he talked with him for about 20 minutes. And then Frank looked down at his recorder, and Dave Kindred, he realized, I didn't turn on my recorder. And he looked at Jack, and he said, Jack, I made a mistake. I didn't turn this on. Could I ask you those questions again? And Jack gave him the old pat on the shoulder and said, let's do it again. And I think where you had Arnold, as you said, so outgoing, so gracious. It took Jack a while, but man, he was really good in those relationships with the media, certainly in the later years.
There was nobody better. He'd come in, and as you say, in the later years, he'd come in on Monday or Tuesday, no longer even playing, but they'd bring him into the press room anyway, because we all wanted to hear him, and he always had something good to say. And he's now, 85, 86 years old, and he's still worth listening to. He understood, and I think that was part of, he grew up in the Bobby Jones era. He grew up idolizing Bobby Jones. And if you have to pick an idol in golf, you can't do better than Bobby Jones and Jack Nicklaus.
Question. We are on our finishing holes with the great Dave Kindred here on Musings on Golf. Okay, so Mr. Kindred, I have three questions for you. Two of them are golf related. Number one, if you could pick out the three favorite golf stories that you've written in your career, what would they be?
If I had to pick out one story that people were likely to have read, it would be Tiger winning in 2019. I, by then, had become softened to the idea of Tiger. I'd seen his trials, his tribulations. I saw his absolute determination to come back. I mean, he won one U.S. Open on a broken leg. Now he's back. How old was he in 2019? They'll say 45. He was. But anyway, 2019, Tiger winning the Masters is perhaps the best newspaper story. I wrote a column daily, I think, for Golf Digest at that time. It was the best thing that I ever wrote about golf on one event. If I had to think of a magazine story. I mentioned Bert Yancey a minute ago. Bert Yancey had been a phenomenon as a young player, developed some kind of mental illness, some kind of mental imbalance, where he would hear people talking to him. And I tracked him down later and wrote a story about his life. He'd been a cadet at West Point. His ambition was to win the Masters. He created the model of the Masters, a hands-on model in his basement of how he would play the hills and the dales and the slopes of the greens. He was a great thinker who somehow lost his way thinking, came back later as a teacher I tracked him down, did a story that I loved. I never heard from him. I didn't expect to hear from him, but it was a story about kind of the strain of golf that changed his life. And if I had to, yeah, and I did a book. I did a book about golf. And this is, to end this on an up note, my buddy Tom Callahan, we were both working at Golf Digest at the time, went around the world and playing golf, wrote a book about it, Around the World in 18 Holes. And if that wasn't the greatest boondoggle of all time, I don't know what is.
It sounds like it.
Somebody gave us $75,000. We spent it all. We went 36,000 miles. We went to 22 countries. We played golf at the Arctic Circle. We played golf teeing off at 3 a.m. and ending at 6 a.m. It was daylight the whole time. The sun went down to the horizon and came back up. I'd never seen that before. We played in South Africa, you know, a green in the shape of the continent of Africa. The tee is elevated tee, hitting down to like the shoulder of Africa over a great water hole filled with crocodiles. You didn't want to go in there looking for a lost ball. You know, we played in everywhere. We had one hole at each of 18 places around the world, made a par 72 around the world. The last hole was a par 5, the 13th at Augusta, where I made 7. Callahan and I wrote about it and lived on it for 5 or 6 years. It was a great memory. So Tiger winning in 2019, Bert Yancey, and around the world in golf. My three golf achievements.
That's fantastic. Before I ask the final question that I typically ask those who are being interviewed, let's talk for a minute about the Lady Potters of Morton, Illinois. John Wertheim of 60 Minutes, as you well know, did a lovely piece that aired 5 years ago this month, Dave Kindred, about that high school basketball team that you covered as you returned to your hometown after retirement. Why? Why did you feel the need to start covering a bunch of girls playing basketball and at a high school level after all the years covering the people you did, and then ultimately that leading to your book, lovely read, My Home Team? Why?
I went to a basketball game. I, as you said, retired. I hate that word retired. I just stopped working for big time publications. I come back to Illinois near my hometown. My sister has a friend in Morton, Illinois. That friend has a daughter playing basketball. The friend says, want to go to a basketball game? Okay, I'm up for a basketball game. We go to a basketball game. The friend's daughter is playing. I had never in 50 years seen a girls' high school basketball game. One of the kind of failings. Title IX happened in like 1973. I paid no attention to Title IX. So Title IX makes this girls' basketball game possible. I watch the game, and halfway through the game, I discover I want to write about this. So I got out a piece of paper, had some ketchup stains on it from a hot dog I had, and started making notes about the game. And somebody tells me that one of the players' fathers creates a website for the girls. So I go to the guy and say, you know, I'd like to write about these girls. I'd like to write about the Lady Potters for you. And he looks at me like, who is this guy that just came out of the stands? Because I was looking like me. I looked like a sports writer. I looked kind of bedraggled. My hair was sideways, and I was wearing blue jeans and just, you know, looked like a bum who had fallen off
the
stand.
You looked the part. You looked the part, right?
Yes. So he says, well, let me talk to the coach. So the coach and I go, we had a meeting the next day, and the coach is also apprehensive, you know, this big-time sports writer. What's he going to say? How's he going to criticize my team, my coaching? I said, no, I'm not here for that. I just want to enjoy it. You know, I think I can, I'd like to write about him. See, I just finished my 16th year writing about the Morton Lady Potters, over 500 games. I've written more words about the Lady Potters than any subject ever, including Muhammad Ali. And I wrote about him for 50 years. So I've enjoyed every minute of it. I didn't know anything. I had no idea how good they were. They were the first 4 years, they were good. They won 20-something games every year. The fifth year, they won a state championship. The sixth year, seventh year, and eighth year, they won state championships again. it became one of the great, great basketball stories of Central Illinois or of Illinois total. And I enjoyed every minute of it. And in the meantime, I have not missed the big time stuff. I write just as passionately and with just as much attention to detail about this girls' basketball team as I ever written about any. I've done 4 books on them. And the book you mentioned so kindly there, Kelly, my home team, half of that was the publisher wanted a biography of me. The last person I want to write about is me. So I did kind of half of the book is about me, how I become whoever it is I am. And the last half of the book is an accounting of my time writing about the Morton Lady Potters. And that's the half of the book that I really cared about. And I still care about it. And I'm trying to decide, is 85 too old to be writing about girls' high school basketball? No. I guess I'll find out next year.
No, the answer to that is no. And also, I'm presuming, Dave Pinder, that the payment structure for all that hard work has continued with the same compensation?
Yes, forever. This father that I talked about who got me into it, like 3 years into it, I said to him, his name was Dave, I said, Dave, you know, I'm a professional sports writer. I should be getting paid something for writing about the Lady Potters for 3 years. And he thought about it. He looked, considered my good looks and said, how about a box of Milk Duds every game? I said, that's a deal. So I've collected maybe 300 boxes of Milk Duds, and that probably added 50 pounds to my weight over this time covering the girls.
You've enjoyed every box, haven't you?
Yes, I have. And I've got 3 more to go. I haven't got through all of them yet.
Dave, I can't tell you how much we've enjoyed this. One final question, as I mentioned, I ask of all of our guests, if you could have and it really is a dream foursome. And I thought about this a lot, like my late father, Max Elvin, was the head professional at Burning Tree in Bethesda, not far from where you worked for many, many years. So he would be someone I'd want to play with. But Dave Kindred, if you had 3 people who you could go out and play a magical round of golf with, and they could be living, they could be deceased, who would they be and where would you go tee it up and what would that be like?
Well, that would be fun. I've wrestled with that question before. And I think I've come up with what the 3 people that I would really enjoy, I think. First of all, it's got to be Palmer. I mean, you can't do this without Arnold Palmer. I mean, we can get sentimental and say dad and mom and all that stuff, but I'm going with Arnold Palmer. And Mickey Wright. Mickey Wright was the first LPGA player that I ever wanted to see. There was an LPGA tournament played in Louisville, Kentucky when I was there. I went out there. Same as when I went to Augusta, I wanted to see Hogan. I went to Hunting Creek Country Club in Louisville, Kentucky, wanting to see Mickey Wright. And I watched her play. And I still remember it was like the 13th or 14th. It was a dogleg left par 4 with a directional flag in the fairway. At 250, she hit that flag. She hit that flag. I still remember that. And she was a sweetheart. She was kind. I don't think she played well that week, but by then she and Kathy Whitworth, who had been dominating the LPGA, were in their later stages. Donna Capone was a star at the time. Anyway, Mickey Wright and Dwight Eisenhower. Arnold Palmer, Mickey Wright, and Dwight Eisenhower. And I say Eisenhower because he was a golfer, because he was instrumental at Augusta, and because I'm now writing a book called, well, I'm not sure what it's going to be called, but I'm now writing a book that is about my father, Dwight Eisenhower, World War II, and Stan Musial.
My God.
That's a book. That's in the works.
Wow.
But Dwight Eisenhower, I knew nothing about Eisenhower as a kid. So I did the necessary research. I went to Abilene. I went to Donora, Pennsylvania. I went to Atlanta, Illinois, my dad's hometown. And I've discovered, to me at least, it was discovery, Dwight Eisenhower's youth, where he wanted to be a professional baseball player. In fact, may have been a professional baseball player for like $5 a game in Abilene in 1913. And when he went to West Point, not to become a great general. He went to West Point to play baseball and to play football. And in fact, played football against Jim Thorpe. Palmer and Eisenhower, I have no doubt, probably played together. You might know that, Kelly, better than I. Yeah, because they were both Republicans. Both. Anyway, Palmer, Eisenhower, and Mickey Wright.
Well, Dave, you know this, but for our listeners, Mickey Wright won 82 times on the LPGA Tour, second only all time to Kathy Whitworth. 13 of her wins were major championships, second only to Patty Berg, who won 15 times. And one of the great golf swings ever, men or women.
Yes. Thank you for that. You know, because I enjoyed meeting her. It was, as I said, it was like meeting Hogan, you know, because she was a legend by that time.
Dave Kindred, this has been an absolute thrill. I thank you for all the wonderful work through the years and the work to come based on what you're telling us with this new book that you're working on. Look forward to talking again in the future. And thank you all for taking time to listen to this wonderful interview with the great Dave Kindred. And we'll talk to you again next week on Musings on Golf. Dave Kindred, thanks again.